It's 7 minutes after 10. I'm Kara Lawrence. My guest today is conductor Andrew Kohler, here today as conductor of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. Welcome once again.
Thank you so much.
Nice to have you back within the space of 7 days. I presume the kickoff to the Junior Symphony season went well on Sunday?
Yes, thank you. It did. You know, it's still a young group, and there are certain nerves that one hears on stage and certain experiences that we're going to learn from on this concert. But by and large, it was a great success.
Beethoven's Fifth.
Yeah.
Can't go wrong. Well, this concert is Saturday. Would you give us the details?
Sure. Well,
when and where and all of that.
Absolutely, yeah. It's this Saturday, 8 p.m., and it'll happen on Kalamazoo College's campus, our Light Fine Arts Center, and in the Dalton Theater there. Tickets are available at the door, and the best deal in town, I think. You're not going to beat $5 for a ticket. That's all we ask.
Okay, that's Saturday night, and this is also the season opening for the K-Phil. Last season, it seems you had a name for the entire season. Are you going the same direction this year?
I am not. And I liked the experience very much last year of doing a whole season devoted to one kind of theme. But there is the risk that it can be too restricting. And I want to make sure I have a lot of other priorities in the balance when you're trying to choose repertoire for the orchestra. And sometimes I think if you're committed to one particular idea for all three concerts of the season, then you might have to make some choices where it's less about what the orchestra needs to grow and what the next steps are for us. So anyway, I still always am committed at the concert level to make sure that the programming has some kind of coherence. But I think only when inspiration strikes will I occasionally go for the season-long exploration of something. So this year we're back to just individual concerts, all of which I hope, as I say, have a coherence to them.
So from looking at the pieces on the program, I get the sense that every piece shows the way a composer looks to the past or looks to a previous composer hero.
Yeah, you've got that exactly right. So I've entitled it Homage, and it's very much an exploration of, something actually that we talk about a lot today. I was thinking about this recently, about the way that when we attend an orchestral concert, there's an expectation for all of us that the music we're going to hear comes from the past. In fact, sometimes I ask my students, my non-musical students even, the question, what is classical music to you? And it's really interesting to hear what they say. Often they say something like, it's written for orchestra. And then I always challenge them and say, but what about opera? What about all these other forms? What about string quartets? Those are not for orchestra. And then they say, oh, right. Well, it's old music. And then I ask them, what if I told you that there are composers alive today who are writing for those very ensembles that you were just discussing? And they seem a little surprised by that. And we've really gotten to a point where contemporary music is almost like a specialty niche. That's problematic for a whole host of reasons, but I'm not going to go into those right now. That's a thornier discussion than we have time for.
I'm ready to name the whole thing a whole different name than classical. We should just start.
Well, there's that issue too. Too many kettles of fish for us to get in here. But in short, what I want to get to is that in the 18th century, for example, that wasn't the case. People would have been very nonplussed by the idea that all of a sudden you show up and are listening to music of your grandfather's generation or something like that.
Kind of boring.
Right, exactly. I mean, styles had changed. They wanted to hear what the latest music being written was. So this is really something that begins in the 19th century, around the middle of the 19th century, just a general sense of historicism, a general sense that the generation that came before them were great masters, that they hoped that they might join them in the pantheon of great artists. And that sense of sort of feeling yourself to be part of this larger flow of history and looking to the past for inspiration is something that has stayed with us up to the present day, interestingly enough. And so, yes, we've sort of deepened, I guess, a look, an examination of that very issue. I mean, not only are we playing music from the past, as almost every orchestra does these days, we're playing music from the past that looks even further to the past, that in some way alludes to or builds upon music of a still earlier composer.
Today's composers have to study the past.
Right.
You cannot even begin to know your own composing voice, it's, I would think, without getting the basics of how great composers of the past handled the challenges of their day.
Right. And that's a very typical way for us to approach music education today. In fact, if you even think of the name of the place where we tend to do this, we do it in a conservatory, right? A place that conserves the past for us. And yet, at the same time, you read accounts of, say, Beethoven or Mozart, of course, because we're obsessed with the past. So, of course, we're reading accounts of Beethoven or Mozart. And we hear things like, they discovered Bach late in their lives. That's a thing. I mean, think about that. Think about how brilliant, I mean, those are among the greatest geniuses we've ever had. And in their training, they would not necessarily have come across Johann Sebastian Bach.
They didn't learn voice leading from reading the chorales.
They had exercises. They had other kinds of exercises that their teachers would have written out for them. They would have written out bass lines and asked them to write in the counterpoint if they were doing the counterpoint exercises. So they didn't necessarily look to the past. And of course, it wasn't as widely available in print, and all those sorts of things kind of added up, I'm sure, to a very different kind of circumstance. But from that point, when you think of the Paris Conservatoire being founded, which was very late in the 18th century, that started to solidify this idea that we were going to preserve the past in our musical study. And it's something, as I say, that stayed with us to the present day.
So you come up with a great concept here, the way composers paid tribute or homage to composers they admired who came before them. Now it's time to fit it to the orchestra and find those pieces that make the orchestra shine.
Yeah.
What did you come up with?
Well, so there are a bunch of different approaches. What we begin with is probably the most direct, literal homage. It's mostly the music of the earlier composer. Then we go into two works that are essentially vehicles that I would classify as variations on a theme. That is to say, they just take one thematic idea from an earlier composer and then use that to build their own music. And then finally, the loosest relationship, which is completely original music, but one just happens to invoke the sound world or some of the characteristic rhythms of an earlier composer. So those in order are the Bach Chaconne. The Bach Chaconne is truly one of the great achievements in Western music. And here I am doubling down again on that larger idea of how we look to the past and are inspired by it. And the thing that makes it such a towering achievement is not only the fact that the Chaconne is really just a dance form. It's a simple dance with a repeating bass line. And here it is written by Johann Sebastian Bach as part of a suite for violin solo. The amount of emotion he manages to wring out of a simple dance is extraordinary. And this work, I mean, some people have, it's quite controversial, but some people have posited maybe he wrote it after the death of his first wife. It's unclear that, like, as I say, that's quite controversial, but there's no question that there's something being very deeply felt in this music. It's longer than all the other movements in that suite combined. The other dances are much more straightforward affairs, lovely, wonderful, as Bach always is, but then all of a sudden there's this crowning 15, 16-minute work at the end for violin solo. The other thing, of course, is that I've mentioned here, it's a dance that has a repeating bass line. And here's the violin, a melody instrument that can't really properly play any bass line. It can only imply it at certain moments. And that is the thing that has inspired generations of composers afterwards to say, well, what would it sound like if we filled in some of those gaps? And what one discovers is that Bach felt free to alter that bass line quite a bit. So it's not a very literal presentation of that bass line each time, but rather sometimes it's filled in with other chromatic tones. Sometimes you have to sort of find the pitch in the middle of the bar. You know, it's not just sort of held through the entire bar. And in those alterations, he's able to really weave this extraordinary architecture. I mean, it really is just a dazzling achievement.
Why don't we hear the original and then discuss a little bit about how a different composer created an orchestral version of it. Again, the Kalamazoo Philharmonia opens its season on Saturday with an 8 p.m. program in the Dalton Theater at the Light Fine Arts Center at Kalamazoo College. Tickets are available at the door, the music office number 337-7070. Here is the Bach Chaconne, or part of it, performed by the great violinist of the mid-20th century, Nathan Milstein. If you tuned in during the music, that was Bach's Chaconne in D minor, a part of the Partita in D minor for solo violin. And my guest is Andrew Kohler. He has selected an orchestral piece that is created out of the Chaconne.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that this composer, Steinberg,
mm-hmm.
pretty much follows the Chaconne we know and doesn't just...
Absolutely. The structure is precisely the same. So bar for bar... The harmonies that are implied often by Bach, or even some of the figuration that he uses, finds its way into the orchestra. What's different, of course, is that where the violin with four strings and two hands is somewhat limited in all the harmonic implications that it can lay out, with the full orchestra at its disposal, Steinberg is able to sort of suggest the totality of the harmony. So, for example, in that last section, we just heard this barrelage of string crossings over and over again. It's really, really exciting to listen to. And he preserves that. It's somewhere in the orchestra. But at the same time, the underlying chorale, you know, the series of chords underneath it that relate back to that repeating bass line will be heard in the orchestra. So that's a good example of how we can hear the difference. The interesting thing is, he's far from the only composer to have tried this. There are several different orchestral arrangements. And there's even some piano arrangements. Brahms, Johannes Brahms, who we play in another work later on the concert, did one just for the left hand of this piece. And he had said, there's a beautiful quote of him talking to his longtime friend, Clara Schumann, and saying, if I could have conceived of a piece like this, just on one stave, you know, an entire world of feelings and emotions. If I could have even conceived of something like this, it would have surely driven me out of my mind. I mean, he was so amazed by Bach's achievement in this music. And another one for piano that realizes the music even more fully, because Brahms is much more keeping just to the original, actually, just sort of transcribing it almost more for piano, is by Federico Busoni. And it's that Busoni version, interestingly, that actually serves as a jumping off point for Steinberg's, the orchestration of the piano version of the original violin. So really, we're deepening...
Stay with you.
Yeah, right, exactly. We're deepening these referential layers here. Steinberg is another really interesting person to discuss for a second, because he's not very well known, Maximilian Steinberg.
I was going to say, what's his first name?
Yes, Maximilian. Maximilian, he's Lithuanian by birth and lived in lived in pre-revolutionary Russia, which then became the Soviet Union. And interestingly, he was very well connected. He's often forgotten today, but he had a slightly more conservative voice, but he was contemporaries with Igor Stravinsky, and often thought at the time in their student days together that Steinberg would be the bigger deal.
He was the
bigger star. And of course, as we know, Stravinsky went off to the West, found fame. Steinberg remained behind. He married Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov's daughter, so he was a son-in-law, and he was also a teacher to Dmitri Shostakovich, among others.
Mm-hmm.
So really important connections to the history of Russian music.
Now, may I ask you a question based on the fact that I haven't heard Steinberg's orchestration? the name in my head that keeps coming up in regards to orchestrations is Stokowski. And I can picture a Stokowski hear in my mind's ear. They get very quite grand, and he brings in so many elements of the orchestra.
Yes, yeah.
Does Steinberg go in that direction here?
To some degree, yeah. I mean, it's an unabashedly romantic, I think, take on it. And this music, I think, has a lot of that potential in it. At the same time, it's a bit more disciplined than the Stokowski. I love Stokowski transcriptions, too. I really do. And I've done quite a few of them. He's very, I guess, you know, since he had the entire Philadelphia Orchestra at his disposal, he tends to just, you know, he'll have contrabassoon play 10 bars and then add 3 more trombones for these 7 bars. So it's a little bit orchestrationally wasteful, even though it's very exciting, the sound of it. So from practical purposes, I did appreciate that Steinberg was a little bit more disciplined, uses the same orchestra throughout. And it seems to me like it just splits the difference between it being really exploiting the fullness, the grandeur of the sound of the orchestra without going overboard.
Bach is sometimes a hard composer to follow. But you're starting the program with Bach, one of his most intense and spiritually altering kind of pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it appropriate to move on to Rachmaninoff without giving Rachmaninoff a bad name?
Oh, I think Rachmaninoff will handle his
own. He can stand up to
this. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're right. The Bach is I mean, we could all just go home, but it's only 17 minutes, and I feel like we owe the the public a little bit more music than that. And I think your qualms will be quickly erased once you hear our soloist, Nicole Lee, who is on faculty at Valparaiso University, someone who I've come into contact with through various, you know, musical circles, and we've done a little bit of chamber music playing together, and she's just a really fabulous, uncommonly thoughtful and musical pianist. We're just really excited to work with her. And this piece is just so dazzling. I mean, it is so virtuosic. It's so brilliant that it occupies a totally different space, I think, in the musical listening pantheon, from spiritual uplift to something that just sort of wows you.
That would be the Paganini variations, of course.
Yes, exactly right. The Rhapsody on a Theme by Paganini, as written by Sergei Rachmaninoff. Here again, interesting connection, we have an original that's written for violin solo. But that original that's written for violin solo was itself a theme in variations and written by maybe the guy who started the whole virtuoso idea, the notion that you could be this world-famous soloist. I mean, Paganini was legendary. He was, you know, people fainting in the audience of his concerts, people whispering about his associations with the devil because he was just so impossibly good at playing the violin. And his book of caprices, he wrote 24 caprices, is still, I mean, it's just, it doesn't get harder than that to play on the violin. And it's the 24th caprice that is this theme in variations. And it's that same theme that Rachmaninoff uses in his piece to write a completely different set of variations, but also very virtuosic, and now, of course, for the piano with an orchestral accompaniment. And interestingly, he writes exactly 24 variations in a subtle allusion to the fact that it comes from the 24th caprice of Paganini. It's really brilliant and at the same time absolutely classically Rachmaninoff. And what I mean by that is that it has his very distinctive orchestrational approach, and that he discovers that Paganini's theme can also be very well married with another theme that Rachmaninoff particularly loves, which is the Dies Irae, the Day of Wrath, this plain chant, medieval era plain chant that Rachmaninoff was obsessed with. He worked into at least half of the compositions that I know of that he wrote. So it often, you know, rears its head in his music, and it does very prominently in this piece too. At the same time, there's a lot of just great beauty in the part writing, and as I say, really dazzling virtuosity.
Nicole Lee will be the soloist. The concert is Saturday at 8 p.m. Here is a recording with Horacio Gutierrez as soloist with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. Thank you. We're listening to the Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini by Rachmaninoff with conductor Andrew Kohler, who will conduct this exciting piece. You cannot stop concentrating for a moment here.
Oh, no. I mean, it is really just hold on to the seat of your pants kind of music making, you know, because the pianists typically in these moments just keep saying, can we please go faster? Could we go a little faster still? You know, they've been playing it their whole life. I think that's often a thing, you know, pianists, the piano is a very immediate instrument, right? You touch something, there's an immediate sound, right? A hammer is striking a string. So it's effectively, in a sense, a percussive instrument. And then the orchestra, by its very nature, is a little bit fatter and rounder, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, somebody's going to blow into a tube that's several feet long. It's going to take a little while till it gets at the end of it. And then, you know, the bass players are going to play a string that's several feet long. And it takes a little while until the sound comes out of it. So you can hear this such a delicate interplay between the orchestra and the pianist. So we really have to be nimble. We really have to stay on our toes. That's one of the things we're working on right now this week.
Do orchestras that are professional and perform and practice together almost every day, do they develop a sense of staying sort of almost ahead of the soloist in order to actually be on time with the soloist?
I think, of course, great orchestras know, have learned what the feeling is to anticipate a beat. I sometimes say that in rehearsal too. It happens sometimes just by sheer distance. You know, you think of the horns at the back of the orchestra, and sometimes by the time they hear the sound, what they're hearing, say from the front of the stage, from the violin, if a horn has to play with the violins or somehow those two parts particularly interact, by the time the sound bounces back from the hall to the back of their stage, you know, there's just enough of a gap that you have to say something to them like, you need to watch instead, or just anticipate a little bit more, play more on top of the beat. So yes, a good musician certainly can do it, but it's a matter of sort of knowing where those moments are where we have to do it. And this would be one of those pieces where we definitely have to be really right on top of the beat.
And it's so fun to study and play music and realize day after day that there's more and more and more you can do, the way that even a single beat, which you think, well, as long as you're exactly on the beat, you're fine. There are infinite gradations,
right,
of where to land.
Yeah, this is a constant thing that one is always refining and learning. And actually, you set me up very beautifully for a quote by Sergei Rachmaninoff himself, who said, music is enough for a lifetime, but a lifetime is not enough for music.
The concert's at 8 o'clock on Saturday. Tickets are available at the door. It's free for K-College students, and it's in the Light Fine Arts Center, in the Dalton Theater inside the Light Fine Arts Center. There's parking, there's a lot right next to the building, and parking on the street available, too.
Absolutely.
We are 15 minutes away from the end of the hour, and there are still two pieces to cover. And the next one is also a substantial and beloved piece.
It is. Yeah. So as I mentioned, I've already invoked the name of Johannes Brahms here in his admiration for Bach. And from that, we might gather that he was a really fervent admirer of the past. And he was. He was really, not only a great composer, but in a sense, one of our first musicologists.
He collected manuscripts.
He did. He had all kinds of older pieces in his library. Today, still, you can buy editions of the Schubert symphonies edited by none other than Johannes Brahms. So he had a real instinct, a real deep relationship with the past. And so it makes perfect sense that, you know, partially because of this relationship with the past, he was very worried about writing his first symphony, a very famous story with Brahms. He waited until he was in his 40s to do it. But on the path until he got there, he wrote many smaller orchestral works to kind of ply his craft as a orchestral composer. And one of them was this series of variations on a theme by Joseph Haydn. Interestingly, for all the musicological benefit we just gave him, now some people question whether or not that was actually Haydn's theme. It might have been someone else's, but at the time it was only known as a theme by Haydn. And it's a great theme. It's called the St. Anthony Chorale. Comes from a divertimento written for wind instruments, and Brahms essentially preserves that scoring at the very beginning. And he's, as opposed to Rachmaninoff, who calls his work a rhapsody, right, and is much more free with the treatment of the theme, Brahms is much more classically oriented. So the structure of the theme. That is to say, it begins with five bar phrases that are repeated, and then there's a longer extension, and then a kind of repeat of that material, and then a sort of triumphant ending, and then that half is also repeated. So two halves that are perfectly balanced, a very clear binary form. He keeps that same structure in each variation. But of course, Brahms being Brahms, just by changing texture, by changing meter, by changing mood, he manages to create sort of an infinite variety of worlds in this music. One nice thing I want to mention, I know we won't have time to hear it, is that in the finale, he takes the theme by Haydn or whomever it might have been, and he turns it into a repeating bass line. So it becomes a double homage also to Bach in a way. So that's another nice little subtle connection.
Is it a fugue or is it just sort of fugal? Or?
It's not really a fugue. It's just really a repeating bass kind of form. Yeah, so you'll be able to, every four bars, you see the same, you can spot the same four notes, sometimes rising in different voices, but they're all there and they're centered around this same basic harmony that can be extracted from this bass line.
I was just, if I put my eyes on it again, yes. Why is it Opus 56A?
Ah, great question. Well, because it was originally written for two pianos. So it's strange that was written first, but then got the B moniker. So that's 56B. But he did initially write it for two pianos and then orchestrated it. But then once they were published, the A got assigned to the orchestration and the B got assigned to the two piano version.
And you said this comes before his four symphonies?
Yeah, this was in his those stage before, why he was just sort of
this long period of teasing the public with
precisely
the
with his brilliance, but not quite ready to commit to a full symphony.
All right, let's hear the famous theme and a few variations. The variations are coming fast and furious in this preview of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia's program called Homage. And my guest is Andrew Kohler. We're nearing the end of the hour, and we have some Ravel to discuss. However, let's finish up on the Brahms, a lovely set of variations that he originally composed on two pianos.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that was the original version, and then it was subsequently orchestrated. And again, the theme is not necessarily by Haydn, as we've discovered, but it is nonetheless a great theme, and Brahms' treatment of it is really so ingenious. And, you know, when he changes things, for example, I was mentioning that there are five-bar phrases, a little unusual to have five-bar instead of four-bar phrases. He typically, characteristically, makes it into the most beautiful gesture. The very next variation we would have just listened to is a long-limbed oboe line, and he just stretches it one bar past the five bars as the oboe keeps sort of crescendoing in this beautiful phrase, and then sort of falls off at the last minute to a subito piano. And it's just gorgeous. And it's so subtle, you know, it's such a nuanced gesture, but so beautiful, so typically Brahms.
So La Valse, also a piano solo piece, right?
I'm not sure. I'm sure that there is a version of it for piano, but
this started as an orchestral piece.
As far as I know, yeah, it was actually intended as a ballet, and it was written with Serge Diaghilev, the famous impresario, in mind. And Ravel played it for Diaghilev, and Diaghilev said, "Ah, it's brilliant, but it's not a ballet, my dear Ravel. It's a portrait of a ballet." Mm-hmm. And this got pretty tense pretty quickly. So Ravel was very angry about it, refused to shake his hand later, apparently. There was almost a duel, all this kind of stuff. But Ravel was very hurt by it, but it, you know, didn't really hurt the reception of the piece in the end. He just called it a choreographic poem, and it became a mainstay of the orchestral repertoire very quickly. Its working title was not La Valse, but actually Vienna, or Wien. And it is a clear allusion to Johann Strauss and the waltzes of Johann Strauss, who is someone that Ravel really much admired. And he had returned to this, the very infectious waltz rhythm, the um-pa-pa, um-pa-pa, many times. He had already written the noble and sentimental waltzes, which is also, that has a piano version, and that was subsequently orchestrated. And you know, he insisted that this was not, there was no political commentary in this music, that it was just about a waltz. It was just about clouds parting. And I think if we'll listen to the beginning of this, we'll hear how brilliantly Ravel orchestrates those clouds, because he's such a deft hand with the orchestra. Clouds parting, and then we look in a massive hall and we see couples dancing. And that was really the only program that was meant to be expressed by this. At the same time, the piece has this specter of violence that seems to be haunting it all the time. So it is just a series of waltzes, very beautiful ones. But many people, though Ravel denied it, point out, here he is writing at the end of World War I, just as the Austrian Empire is dissolving. Could not maybe there be some commentary about how this way of life is falling apart?
Yeah.
It's difficult not to hear it that way for me, I have to say, because as I point out, if you come on Saturday night and hear the entire work, you'll hear at the end of how these charming waltzes are interrupted very violently over and over again. And the end of the piece just sounds a bit as if the dance floor collapses and everybody falls right through it.
I want to share with you a description given to me by a pianist who did play a transcription of La Valse on the Gilmore Rising Stars series. And her name escapes me at the moment. But I remember her, what guides her through the piece, the images that guide her, mm-hmm. as picturing a palace of old, and, mm-hmm. and wandering through rooms and hearing music just out of sight, just in another room, and different scenarios and people in different ballrooms as she's trying to find her way through a somewhat spooky palace.
I think that's a beautiful description, and it does fit the work very well. There's a sense that somehow this world is just out of reach.
Andrew, thank you so much for coming in and previewing this concert. All the best for Saturday night.
Thank you very much, Kara.